Welcome to The Wicket.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cricket Conversation from Arab News here at The Wicket. I'm Brian Murgatroyd and with me as ever to dissect the latest goings on in the sport locally in the Gulf, regionally in Asia and worldwide, Arab News columnist John Pike and Arab News cricket reporter Subhash Hamagain. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Brian. Hi, Subhash.
Hi, John. Hi, Brian.
And in this episode, we chat about week three of the Indian Premier League. We preview the ACC Premier Cup, the T20 international tournament for the leading sides outside the top tier, and one that will feature Saudi Arabia. We look at Sri Lanka's women and their historic T20I series win in South Africa, and also wrap up the England women's white ball tour of New Zealand. We review the second test of the Bangladesh-Sri Lanka men's series in Chattagram. We talk about the USA-Canada T20I series, a dress rehearsal for the opening match of this year's men's ICC T20 World Cup. Plus, we reflect upon the story of batter Usman Khan and the Emirates Cricket Board's reaction to his decision to declare for Pakistan rather than the UAE. And on top of all that, Subhash and John give us their personal highlights from the past week. So, as ever, lots to get our teeth into. As we record this podcast, we're 2.5 weeks into the Indian Premier League. Since we last spoke, Rajasthan Royals have made it 4 wins from 4 starts, including a Joss Butler 100 to trump a Virat Kohli 100 in a victory over Royal Challengers Bengaluru. Kolkata Knight Riders have pummeled Delhi Capitals for a record score of 272/7, winning by 106 runs to turbocharge their net run rate and torpedo Delhi's. Punjab have sensationally chased down 200 to beat last year's runners-up, the Gujarat Titans. Pat Cummins' Sunrisers Hyderabad have overcome Chennai Super Kings. Mumbai and Hardik Pandya have had their first win at the expense of Delhi, with Romario Shepherd thumping Anrich Norkia for 32 in an over, while Lucknow Super Giants made light of the loss of speedster Mayank Yadav by overcoming the Titans thanks to Yash Thakkar's 5 for 30, the best figures of this year's tournament so far. On top of that, champion CSK comfortably eased past KKR by 7 wickets to inflict a first loss on the Knight Riders. Subhash, first things first, with that record score for KKR, what do you make of them? They did, of course, lose to CSK, but Mitchell Stark has finally taken his first wickets of the tournament against Delhi. But more importantly, they're batting with Phil Salt, Ankrish Raghavanshi, Andre Russell, Shreyas Iyer and Rinku Singh. That looks frightening, doesn't it? Especially when you throw in the pinch hitting of Sunil Narine, who made 85 from just 39 balls against Delhi.
Yeah, if you look at the paper, they look very strong, but we see an instance where nothing goes right as well. So it's make or break from right at the top. Andre Russell can do damage in the middle with Rinku Singh, but it's Sunil Narine that sets the tone. If he goes up firing, I think KKR off to our flyer start and the big score is up on the horizon. But I think they'll need someone like Nitish Rana or Shreyas Iyer to take up that role when the wickets go falling to accommodate the inning. Maybe keep the wickets saving for Russell and Rinku to fire. Both of these, I think if they come in early, they can't show up their natural talent. So they have that batting firepower, but I think they should use their resources well, looking at how they feel and Sunil start up top.
John, Delhi look like a side in desperate trouble, don't they? Thumped by KKR, they were then crushed by previously winless Mumbai, and one of their marquee players, fast bowler Anrich Norkia, is being hit everywhere. He's conceded 215 runs in 16 overs at an eye-watering 13.43 runs per over. It's been a disaster so far for Delhi, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I think there's a serious issue on how to reset Norkia. I mean, he's quick, but then so are others. And we know at the end of an innings, the white ball doesn't do very much. Maybe he's trying too hard. Maybe he's conscious that another injury is around the corner. I think he probably needs somebody to teach him a new trick. I wonder what Cricket South Africa are thinking about all of this.
John, you did say, though, in the previous episode that if Jos Buttler found form, then that would take Rajasthan to another level. And that's exactly what happened against RCB, a brilliant 100. And although you win nothing at this stage of the tournament, of course, you have to say that Rajasthan continue to impress, don't they? Even without a meaningful contribution from Yashasvi Jaiswal. Can you talk to us about both those players, John? Butler's return to form and Jaiswal's search for it.
Well, as anyone who's ever played cricket at any level knows, form's a fragile thing. And of course, expectation is one of the variables which affects that, along with management of confidence. Lose it, and you never know when it's going to return. I mean, from the boundary, Butler looked pretty dead beat in the World Cup. His style is sort of understated, it doesn't really rouse the troops. And freed of the captaincy in the IPL, he's got the chance to reset under what I assume will be an empathetic management. They know what he's capable of doing, and it's in their interest to bring that out. Jaiswal looks a different case. Maybe the expectations have been too high, and he's finding the adjustment difficult. Perhaps he can take a look at Joss and see how he's come through it for a lesson.
Yes, he was a star player in last year's IPL, Yashasvi Jaiswal, but he's come down to earth with a bump now. Let's see if he can pull himself together as the tournament continues. Subhash, what about RCB? Virat Kohli, he's clicking, but little else seems to be. They're already now having ground to make up near the foot of the table, just one win from their first five matches. Is this season's script of another failure written already for them, or is there any way that they can turn things around?
I think it will be very tough to turn the season around because they've gone with the same intent, firing batsmen up top, but it's the bowling they're lacking on. I think we spoke about the spin attack not being strong at the start of season, and that's what we've seen. I think bowling attack has been below average. Virat Kohli, 5 2-pleces have done their job, but I think even the batting order has faltered at times. If you look at the results, that Dinesh Karthik innings was the only positive and only result that they've got on their side. Kohli and Faf, I think they have been too defensive because they know that down the order the batting is not good. So they've started with runs, but not with the intent, the attacking batting that they should be starting with. I think one of them should come down at number 3. And maybe give Will Jacks a chance, who has proven that even in subcontinent conditions he can fire. So I think there should be some change up the order, and that means one of either Cameron Green or Glenn Maxwell should sit out, because that's the way it is for RCB. So they'll need to change their approach, but if they keep on going like this, I think it's another season without a playoff spot for them.
Doesn't look very promising at this stage for them, that's for sure. But Subhash, what about Mumbai's run riot against Delhi? Is this the result to turn around their season? I have to say, there were no boos for Hardik that I heard after that win.
Yeah, I think they were much needed of that result. The dressing room needed that result, just not just for the confidence, but for the environment that they needed. They had a hard start. The leadership has been a huge problem, but we saw Hardik back happy, smiling with the players. And I think Romario Shepherd has a lot to do with that. So I think they've got the balance right with Romario coming in and firing that. Tilak Barma looks in excellent touch as well. So the results like this should come often. And I think Rohit Sharma has a lot to do making that dressing room environment good now. And I think he'll do that considering the matches that are to come. They have no place for any more failures.
John, the Gujarat Titans, they're struggling a little with 2 wins from their first 5 matches. In contrast to their form last season, when, of course, they were losing finalists. Is it as simple as saying that Shubman Gill isn't scoring the volume of runs he did last season yet? Or is there more to it than that, do you think?
We and I think many others have wondered about the longer-term effects on Gill of making him captain. Against Lucknow, the bowlers did their job to restrict the score to 163. It was the batters, not just Gill, who let them down. They were 54 for naught and then 61 for 4. Terrific effort from Yash Thakur. And we know that Lucknow have got a very good record at home, generally low-scoring ground, and they've got bowlers who have adapted. It's a bit more to it than just Shubman Gill failing to score the volume of runs.
Subhash, Lucknow produced a terrific win against the Titans after scoring a seemingly modest 163-45, and then losing Mayank Yadav to injury. Justin Langer seems to have got a tune out of them so far, doesn't he? What do you put that down to?
I think the team has been terrific. Even without Mayank, the spin attack, especially Krunal Pandya. So the other Pandya has been in the highlights, but I think it's Krunal who we should be talking about. And for right reasons, his spinning bowling has been quite effective. Ravi Bishnoi partnered with him in this last win. So I think the bowling has come good, especially the spin bowling. And Mayank Yadav, I think he was arrested as a precautionary measure. And with his reputation, I think BCCI will look at his load balancing act as well. But Marcus Stone is firing is another positive thing. And Nicholas Puran, I think he's been fantastic throughout the IPL. And he will be the key if Lucknow wants to make that top two spot this time.
There is, of course, still a long way to go in this tournament, and we'll be across everything that's happened here at The Wicket every week on this podcast. It's time to switch now from domestic T20 action in the IPL to internationals, and the Asian Cricket Council Premier Cup gets underway in Oman on Friday, the 12th of April. It features 10 teams playing in T20Is. That's Bahrain, Cambodia, Hong Kong, Kuwait, Malaysia, Nepal, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and the hosts. And the top side will go forward to next year's Asia Cup, which features the region's heavy hitters, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan and Sri Lanka. The good news is that The Wicket will be well represented at the event, with both John and Subhash in attendance to provide us with in-depth analysis of all the action. In case you weren't aware, 8 of the sides in Oman are at this stage because of their positions in the ICC rankings, but Saudi Arabia and Cambodia won through to the ACC Premier Cup after finishing as the top two sides in the ACC Men's Challenger Cup in Thailand in February, a tournament we covered in depth here at The Wicket. The hosts completed their preparations, that's Oman, for the tournament with a 5-match series against Namibia. They lost that 3-2, but they got some good hard match action ahead of the ACC event. We chatted about the Premier Cup in our previous episode too, and if you haven't heard that, then please go back after this episode to have a listen. But now we're on the eve of the event, let's go through in a bit more detail the prospects of some of the leading sides on show. John, let's talk about the hosts first. Oman's series against Namibia may have ended in defeat, but it looks like they've still ticked quite a few boxes ahead of the Premier Cup. Akib Ilyas, perhaps their top batter, scored runs and actually reached 1,000 T20I runs in the course of that series, while their seamers Mehran Khan and Fayaz Butt took wickets. They appear in good shape, don't they?
Yes, although they came a cropper in that final match, as Namibia posted, 212 for 3 on a pitch on which runs had been hard to come by in previous matches. Oman then collapsed from 106 for 2 to 150 all out. The team has been ageing for some time. We've got Bilal Khan still rushing in at 37 years of age, and you wonder how much longer they can keep pushing the boundaries, especially in T20, in which fielding fitness can be crucial.
Yes, it's a fair observation that, and it's something I actually mentioned to Duleep Mendis, their coach and mentor, during the 50-over World Cup qualifier in Zimbabwe last year. And he was certainly conscious of the need to try and bring on the next generation of players sooner rather than later. Let's see how they get on, though, in this tournament in the short term. John, let's also talk about the UAE under recently appointed coach Lalchand Rajput. They've got batting power with Mohammad Wasim and Asif Khan. And the good news, too, is that all-rounder Ali Nazir is also available. They've had a training camp in Dubai for the best part of a month to get ready for this tournament. Do they have what it takes to go all the way?
They're a blend of youth and experience. And the coach is looking for the team to bat aggressively, but don't throw wickets away when set. Build partnerships. I mean, this is a mantra common to many. The new coach, he's seen ODIs lost to Canada and Scotland, plus a 2-1 defeat to Scotland in T20s. He's obviously taking time to build trust. They should get through the group stage. Whether they're good enough to go all the way, Well, I think it's in the balance.
Yes, they're missing Mohammed Jawadullah, who is an expert T20I bowler, the left-armer who played for Sharjah Warriors in the most recent ILT20. He's recuperating following surgery after an injury. So I think he will be a significant loss for the UAE, no question about that. Sebash, why not talk to us about Nepal's preparations? You mentioned on the previous podcast about the team spending time in India. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Yeah, I think India was a team's plan to practice as well as have some match action with state teams. We're under strength with IPL going on, but I think they played a tri series with Gujarat and Baroda, who is known for producing top-notch talents. And we saw some close competition as well. I think Nepal were up to their best, tested to their best, lost one match in the league round, but were convincingly winning the title. I think it was more about getting used to the new conditions with Oman being hot and humid. And you don't get that atmosphere in Nepal right now. So I think they had good preparation. But come Oman, I think it will be a totally different challenge. And I hope the team's up for it.
A couple more things on the subject of Nepal, that West Indies A series being announced, and also that Nepal have signed up West Indian bowling coach Roddy Estwick as a coaching consultant for the T20 World Cup in the West Indies and the USA. Just talk to us about those two things. First of all, the tour from West Indies A to Nepal. That's great news, isn't it?
Yeah, great news. I think the biggest team coming to Nepal in recent history, and I think it's all down to our success in the associate world. We got Ireland Wolves, and I think West Indies are one of the best T20 teams in the world, and we're getting their A side just before the World Cup. And West Indies, I think going to West Indies, so having them here testing ourselves against the second rest of the best is an excellent opportunity for us. I hope the number of matches we played in recent times will be a issue with players' fatigue. But West Indies, I think you never soon say no to them. And regarding the appointment of Roddy Estwick, I think it's a lot down to Monty Desai, who was part of the coaching staff in West Indies. So they spent 3 years together with the West Indian team, and Nepal are going to West Indies for the first time. So he's one of the best bowling coaches available for that reason. And another thing is the happy dressing room that Coach Monty Desai emphasizes a lot. And since he's worked with Estwick for 3 years, I think it will be easier for Estwick to get onto Nepal's happy dressing room and maintain the environment and not make anything new, but just continue with the flow that the team is going on.
Just to confirm, the groups in Oman, by the way, Group A features Hong Kong, Malaysia, Nepal, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And Group B has Bahrain, Cambodia, Kuwait, Oman, and the UAE. Hong Kong versus Nepal looks like a key matchup in Group A, whilst Oman and the UAE is the Group B blockbuster. After the group stages, there are crossover semi-finals with the runners-up in one group playing the winners of the other, followed by a third and fourth place playoff and the final. John, what about Saudi Arabia? What have their preparations been like? We spoke in the previous podcast about the need for them to step up in this company, but we also mentioned that this format is the one that they're most likely to spring a surprise in. Who should we be watching out for, do you think?
Well, they've been working on their fitness and training camp. They've done 4 or 5 hours per evening. Best ever camp, according to the coach. He's obviously happy to have the players together, as they are part-time and geographically spread. Confidence is high after back-to-back victories in the Challenger Cups. Don't forget, last year was the ODI format. They will play with a positive mindset, with a view to causing a surprise or two. So one would expect the openers to set the pace. Abdul Wahid and Faisal Khan, as the captain, Hisham Sheikh, provides all-round support at number six.
Incidentally, there's plenty of detail about cricket in Saudi Arabia on the Arab News website and, of course, build up to this tournament too. Just visit www.arabnews.com/cricket and there'll be plenty more at that location during the tournament too, not just on Saudi Arabia, but on the whole tournament, thanks to Sebash and John. So please get across there to have a read. A reminder, the action gets underway on Friday, the 12th of April. Sri Lanka's women have recorded a historic T20i series win against South Africa in South Africa. After losing game one, they bounced back with successive victories, and in the decisive match in East London, they won by 4 wickets with 5 balls to spare, chasing 156. We spoke in the previous podcast about the lack of runs in the first 2 matches for Chamari Attapattu, and sure enough, she delivered when it really mattered in that decisive game with 73 from 46 balls. In the past year, Sri Lanka have won a series in England, they've reached the final of the Asian Games, and now they've won a series in South Africa. Subhash, if they qualify for the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh, and remember, they still have to go through that process in the UAE later this month and into May, they could well be dark horses for at least a semi-final berth at that mega event, couldn't they?
Yeah, I think the qualifier process as a whole, I think Sri Lanka coming down to play the qualifiers is a big surprise for me. I think the team, they've got world-class players and look like world beaters on their day. And Chamari Attapattu is one of the best women cricketer at the moment. But the qualifier, I think that will be a test for them. You never know what comes up. I think they need to be at their best. And after that, I think World Cup will be a whole new journey. And we've seen Sri Lanka producing excellent matches, even just recently. It's not just about Chamari, but the newcomers, they'll need to prove themselves that it's not about a single player only. So I think Sri Lanka first, they should worry about the UAE qualifiers, and I think they can make it after that for the World Cup.
Yes, a reminder that T20 World Cup qualifier that Sri Lanka will compete in will be played at 2 venues in Abu Dhabi, the Zayed Cricket Stadium and also the next door Tolerance Oval, which staged the Afghanistan Island Test match recently. The tournament is set to begin on April the 25th with the final on May the 7th, with not only Sri Lanka, but also Ireland, the Netherlands, Scotland, Thailand, Uganda, the UAE, the USA, Vanuatu, and Zimbabwe taking part. 2 sides will go forward to the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh. The 2 sides will now play a 3-match one-day international series that forms part of the ICC Women's Championship, and we'll update you on the action in that format in our next episode. That Women's Championship has 10 teams battling for 6 spots in the ICC Women's Cricket World Cup in India next year, with the 4 sides below the line facing the prospect of playing in the qualifier. As we record this episode, the order is Australia, top of the shop, South Africa, England, New Zealand, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, West Indies and Ireland. India will qualify automatically as hosts no matter where they finish in the Women's Championship, but they've also played fewer matches than any other team. West Indies, meanwhile, they do have matches in hand on those sides above them. We'll chat about the T20 World Cup qualifier in more detail closer to that start date on April the 25th. One other news line for you from Sri Lanka is that the men's team wrapped up their 2-match test series against Bangladesh, winning the second match by 192 runs. The match was only ever heading one way after Sri Lanka piled up 531 in their first innings and then dismissed Bangladesh for just 178 first time around. There were more runs for Kamindu Mendis, who scored an unbeaten 92 in the first innings and later took 3 wickets. And this followed his twin hundreds in the first test in Sylhet. He was unsurprisingly named the ICC Men's Player of the Month for March. John, what a great start for Dhananjaya da Silva as test captain. And interestingly, it was the seamers who did the majority of the damage there in Bangladesh, in Sylhet and then Chattogram. Vishwa Fernando, Lahiru Kumara and Kasan Rajitha shared 29 wickets between them. If they can stay fit, and it's always a big if with Sri Lanka's seamers, they could test England's batters this coming summer, couldn't they?
Well, first of all, it's a fantastic start for da Silva. And it gives the series against England a spice that may have been lacking, though it does seem that ticket sales have been good. Unfortunately, we've got to wait until the middle of August for the 3-match test series at Manchester, Lords and the Oval. But they could be a handful depending on whatever conditions occur at the middle to end of August and into September.
Subhash, why were Bangladesh so poor in this series? They had an inexperienced attack. There were 2 seamers, Hassan Mahmood and Nahir Rana, who made their test debuts. But they were playing on pitches that were more seamer friendly than normal in the country. Is that a reason or an excuse, especially for the disappointing batting? They made 188, 182, 178 and 318. And let's be honest, that's never going to win you tests or series, is it?
I think, yes, you explained it pretty well, Brian. If you look at the totals, I think getting bowled out below 200 is, I think you should never look for an excuse except that. You've got two young bowlers and I think they'll need to have a score to they should be bowling at. Your team hasn't scored even 200 and it's very tough to fight against these teams. I think the first test itself, Bangladesh had a moment in that test, but it was a great tough Dhananjay Silva and Kamindo Mendis that brought them back. Come second match, I think this had a bit of better batting, but once again, I think the seeming conditions is not favouring Bangladeshi cricket at all. But I think if they get used to playing in these conditions and the batter and bowlers get game time, I think this will be great. So it's a bit of a risk, but I think earlier days, the signs aren't nice, but I think they should continue this if they are to get success in overseas conditions as well.
England's women wrapped up their white ball tour of New Zealand with a 2-1 series win against the hosts, following on from a 4-1 series win in the T20Is. We spoke about England's come-from-behind success in the first one-day international on the previous podcast, and they wrapped up the 50-over series in match two with a convincing win thanks to Tammy Beaumont's 81, 48 from only 40 balls from Amy Jones, and 3 for 21 for Nat Sivabrunt, beating New Zealand by 56 runs. The home side won the third and final match by 7 wickets, chasing 195 for victory, as Sophie Devine scored a brilliant 100 not out from only 93 balls. That victory may have seemed like nothing more than a consolation win for New Zealand, but it was far more than that, as the 2 points in the Women's Championship that it earned lifted them to fourth in the table and gave them some breathing space ahead of the sides below them. England are sitting comfortably in third spot. Subhash, it was interesting for me to hear Sophie Devine speaking after the final match and that win for New Zealand. And in her words, that win validates the work we've been doing behind the scenes. And she also said, when we get things right, we're hard to beat. Is all that fair comment, or is it merely talking up a side that, let's be honest, has been an also-ran for quite a while now?
I think it's a bit of a both. She must be disappointed that the senior players have not got the backing from newcomers. But the final game, I think, getting to the century with the 6 winning runs, it was a special for Devine, who's been working really hard. And I think the tough period is yet to come with, I think they've got a series against Australia and India, the two toughest opponent, and you have the mathematics of the points table along with it. So I think this was much needed 2 points and to get the momentum ahead of 2 big series. So maybe she wants to get the team back up high because they need it so bad if they are to qualify direct to the World Cup.
Well, in terms of England and New Zealand, these two sides haven't got long before they renew acquaintance as they face each other in the UK in 3 one-day internationals and 5 2020 internationals in June and July, all part of their preparations for the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh at the end of the Northern Hemisphere summer. Well, you might not have noticed it, and don't worry if you didn't, because you're not alone, but the USA and Canada's men are playing in a 5-match T20I series in Houston, Texas. It's significant for a number of reasons, not least because it represents a part of the USA's on-field build-up towards the T20I World Cup that they're jointly hosting with the West Indies in June and July, and also because it's the latest instalment of the oldest international rivalry in cricket history. Yes, forget England against Australia. Canada and the USA is the international contest widely recognised to be the earliest international fixture, with the two countries first meeting in 1844. And there's even a trophy for matches between the two sides, the Orty Cup, although it's not been announced whether it's being contested in this series. Andreas Gaus, the South African, now qualified for the USA and a player who made an impact in the ILT 20 in the UAE for the Abu Dhabi Knight Riders at the start of this year, is in the USA squad, as is Corey Anderson, the former New Zealand all-rounder. Gauss made 50 from 35 balls as the USA won match one of the series by 6 wickets, while Anderson sat that game out with a sore calf. Subhash, can we read anything into the results in this series, do you think? A USA side with Gauss plus Monant Patel, who's their captain, Ali Khan, the fast bowler, and Corey Anderson all firing could be dangerous in that World Cup, couldn't they?
Yeah, I think USA were much in need of this series because they've got new players coming in. They want to test their squad balance, the individuals coming to the team, how they will play. We've seen them play in the minor league cricket, even in the last Nepal's preparatory series. I heard of League 2 2 years back. I think Andrew Scouse was part of a match in one of the games. So I think they've got them tested in the domestic setup, but the World Cup is a biggest stage. And I think some players have changed their nationality coming into the new team. I think Canada will be a right test. The team is on form. USA are trying to check a balance, and this could have been better for both the teams.
John, there was no sponsor signage visible at that first match. Nothing on the USA jerseys, and that pitiful crowd I mentioned, as well as very basic facilities at the venue. Why is it, do you think, that the USA struggles to get its act together in a cricketing sense? Last year, they finished last in the ICC Cricket World Cup qualifier in Zimbabwe. I just wonder, why have they been this sporting basket case for so long? And do you see signs of an upswing with the USA's own T20 league starting last year, plus this T20 World Cup on the horizon?
Well, there's quite a lot riding on these events to stimulate interest amongst the non-Indian, non-South Asian diaspora is pretty sceptical. And of course, there's the 2028 Olympics to take into account. I think part of the issue is been dubious government practices by the US authorities in charge of cricket, and these need to be put right. I've tried before and failed, and I think unless they get that right, then there are always going to be problems. And interesting, the main PR coverage at the moment seems to focus on the building of the stadium in New York, perhaps to detract from the criticisms that you've just raised.
Yes, there have been some very stunning photos of that stadium in New York, but there's still work to do and plenty of it ahead of the start of the tournament. Subhash, let's look at Canada. They've got the experienced Sri Lanka coach Prabhudu Dasanayake at the helm. Can you see them moving in the right direction after years in the doldrums? They've already made a great start to life in World Cup League 2, haven't they? Which is a vehicle for qualifying for the next 50-over Cricket World Cup, played 4-1-4 against the UAE and Scotland.
Yeah, the UAE series was a dream start for them, getting back-to-back wins at the top of the League 2 at the moment. But I think they'll need to see where the squad is. Not having Kalim Sana in this US series is an issue. He was nursing an injury when he came to Nepal, was excellent in the UAE, but once again, he's back out injured. So the left-arm seamer is, I think, one of the best players Canada has. Batting-wise, I think they produced good performance in the UAE and will look to continue so in the shorter format. Ryan Khan Pathan being left out was a huge surprise with the hitting he does. I think he's second to none in Canada squad. So I think Prabhudu is still getting on to this T20 squad. He has good bunch of players. I think Canada do not have a good domestic setup, but there are a lot of talent hunts going on, and Prabhudu is looking for a good squad. And this was a good time to test the players. But I think without Kalim Sana and Ryan Khan Pathan, they'll struggle in this sort of format.
Pakistan men's team has wrapped up a preparatory camp in Abbottabad ahead of a busy few months that include the T20 World Cup. And one player who attended was Usman Khan, a batter who's been at the centre of a major news story. Usman previously declared for the UAE and was qualifying to play for them. He took part in the ILT20 at the start of the year as a local player. And when he played for the Quetta Gladiators in the Pakistan Super League after that, he did so as an overseas player. However, after scoring 430 runs in 7 matches, he was approached by Pakistan to ascertain his availability. He joined up with the camp, and now the ECB has banned him from all their events, including the Abu Dhabi T10 and the ILT20, for 5 years, accusing him of bad faith. Usman Khan, for his part, well, he's been named in a Pakistan squad to play in a T20I series against New Zealand that's all part of the build-up towards that T20 World Cup. John, the whole banning of Usman does seem a little bit tough, as far as I can see. Put yourself in his shoes. Suddenly, after years when no one's interested in him in Pakistan, something that prompted him to look elsewhere for a future, suddenly he's on the cusp of appearing in a T20 World Cup for the country of his birth. Is it any surprise that his head's been turned?
Well, this one's got a bit of a bitter taste to it. It looks to me as if the situation could have been handled better on the PCB side. Now, I don't know if they entered into any discussion with the Emirates Cricket Board prior to Khan being called up to the PCB training camp. I mean, yes, one can understand that his head would be turned by the invitation. On the other hand, he seems to have no contrition. Put yourself in the ECB's shoes. You seem very angry by him taking up a local slot in IOT20, you know, that could have gone to someone else. I mean, they argue they invested in him in good faith, and that faith has been compromised. It's a sort of situation that led to transfers in football. To say the decision looks designed to deter others, I don't think it's tough, but it may backfire. And the question is whether it's proportionate. And I think that depends on which horse you back on the Verity Stakes.
It is a very, very tough sanction, no question about that. 5 years is a long time in a player's career. Subhash, can you understand Usman's decision to turn his back on the UAE? Or would you have advised him perhaps to stick with the associate country, given in a worst-case scenario he might be cast off by Pakistan quite quickly if he fails, and now he's got nothing to fall back on with the UAE?
Well, I think Usman has his rights to go back to the country. He's dreamed to play for. If he had looked at the finances, I think he'd have stick with he get to play two of the handsomely paid leagues, ILT20 and T10 league. And apart from that, I think you'll have more playing time for the franchise league if you are with associate country. But I think he had no intention of earning more money or getting big contracts with Emirates Cricket Board. I think it's about getting to play for your country. He was in UAE because he didn't get to play for Pakistan, or he didn't get any chance. But once he did, I think it was a no-brainer for him, and that's been the case. To play for your country is the ultimate dream for every individual, and I think Usman was right to do so. The case could have been handled a bit easier with communications, but I think the ECB are right in their case. They've kept their faith, they've spent finances on him, but I think it's a sour end to a good relation that could have been handled better.
Yes, it's a sad situation from that point of view, but all credit to Usman Khan if he goes on and plays in a T20 World Cup for the country of his birth, Pakistan. Rest assured, we'll keep an eye on his progress here at the wicket. You can be sure of that. And finally, gentlemen, as we always do, let's hear from you about something that's caught your attention this week in the world of cricket. John, first of all.
Well, I've survived yet another Chiang Mai Sixers. Reaching the semi-finals of the cup competition, the highest of the groups, was my team's highest position, I think, for several decades. A terrific week of cricket, cementing friendships forged over many years. There were 10 teams from different countries. There's a new team this year from Laos, not known for cricketing prowess. Covered all that in last week's column. And I think if any listeners require more information about the tournament or indeed submitting a team into it, go on to the Chiang Mai International Sixers website.
Absolutely. And I can recommend John's column as well at the Arab News website, arabnews.com/cricket. If you want to read John's column on the Chiang Mai Sixers, it's a lovely read and well worth your time. Subhash, what's tickled your fancy this week?
So Nepal had released their World Cup cricket jersey and has not gone down well with the fans with inclusion of yellow colour. I think the fans were used to blue and red and the combination of it, but the yellow being included in the jersey has seen a lot of fans unhappy, but I think it's about the performance that comes along with it rather than just the jerseys. But we've been in a good run, but you can never please fans, do you?
Well, if a team jersey is the worst thing that the Nepal fans have to complain about, then it's happy days, I think, all round. But we'll see how they get on in that new jersey in the T20 World Cup, of course, in June, and hopefully from Nepal's perspective, July as well. Well, that's it for another episode of The Wicket. We'll be back soon with more cricket chat from the Gulf region, Asia and worldwide. Please don't forget to like, subscribe and comment on what you've heard wherever you get your podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback and let us know if there's anything you'd like us to feature in future episodes. For now, though, this is Brian Murgatroyd along with John Pike and Subhash Hamagain saying thanks for listening, and we look forward to your company again next time.